with straw strewn upon it, and it was coming to me slowly that I might be in some sort of jail. But the wine, it had been too good for a jail. Who would give a prisoner wine like that, unless, of course, the prisoner was to be executed? And another aroma came to me, rich and overpowering, and so delicious that it made me moan. I looked about, or I should say I tried to look about, because I was almost too weak to move. But the source of this aroma was near to me, and it was a large bowl of beef broth. The broth was thick with bits of meat, and I could see the steam rising from it. It was still hot. I grabbed it in both hands immediately, and I drank it as thoughtlessly and greedily as I drank the wine. It was so satisfying, it was as if I'd never known any food like it, that rich, boiled-down essence of the meat. And when the bowl was empty, I fell back, full, almost sick, on the straw. It seemed something moved in the darkness near me, but I was not sure. I heard the chink of glass. "More wine," said a voice to me, and I knew the voice. Gradually I began remembering everything, scaling the walls, a small square rooftop, that smiling white face. For one moment I thought, no, quite impossible. It must have been a nightmare. But this just wasn't so. It had happened, and I remember the rapture suddenly, the sound of the gong, and I felt myself grow dizzy as though I were losing consciousness again. I stopped it. I wouldn't let it happen. And fear crept over me so that I didn't dare to move. "More wine," said the voice again. Turning my head slightly, I saw a new bottle, corked, but ready for me, outlined against the window's luminous glow. I felt the thirst again, and this time it was heightened by the salt of the broth. I wiped my lips, and then I reached for the bottle, and again I drank. I fell back against the stone wall, and I struggled to look clearly through the darkness, half afraid of what I knew I would see. Of course, I was very drunk now. I saw the window, the city. I saw the little table, and as my eyes moved slowly over the dusky corners of the room, I saw him there. He no longer wore his black hooded cape, and he didn't sit or stand as a man might. Rather, he leaned to rest, it seemed, upon the thick stone frame of the window, one knee bent a little towards it, the other long, spindly leg sprawled out to the other side. His arms appeared to hang at his sides. And the whole impression was of something limp and lifeless, and yet his face was as animated as it had been the night before. Huge black eyes seeming to stretch the white flesh in deep folds, the nose long and thin, and the mouth the jester's smile. There were the fang teeth just touching the colourless lip, and the hair, a gleaming mass of black and silver growing up high from the white forehead and flowing down over his shoulders and his arms. I think that he laughed. I was beyond terror. I could not even scream. I had dropped the wine. The glass bottle was rolling on the floor, and as I tried to move forward to gather my senses and make my body more than something drunken and sluggish, his thin, gangly limbs found animation all at once. He advanced on me. I didn't cry out. I gave a low roar of angry terror and scrambled up off the bed, tripping over the small table and running from him as fast as I could. But he caught me in long white fingers that were as powerful and as cold as they had been the night before. "Let me go, damn you, damn you, damn you," I was stammering. My reason told me to plead, and I tried. "I'll just go away, please, let me out of here. You have to let me go." His gaunt face loomed over me, his lips drawn up sharply into his white cheeks, and he laughed a low, riotous laugh that seemed endless. I struggled, pushing at him uselessly, pleading with him again, stammering nonsense and apologies, and then I cried, "God help me!" He clapped one of those monstrous hands over my mouth. "No more of that in my presence, Wolfkiller, or I'll feed you to the wolves of hell," he said with a little sneer. "Hmm? Answer me. Hmm?" I nodded, and he loosened his grip. His voice had had a momentary calming effect. He sounded capable of reason when he spoke. He sounded almost sophisticated. He lifted his hands and stroked my head as I cringed. "Sunlight in the hair," he whispered, "and the blue sky fixed forever in your eyes." He seemed almost meditative as he looked at me. His breath had no smell whatsoever, nor did his body, it seemed. The smell of mold was coming from his clothes. I didn't dare to move, though he was not holding me. I stared at his garments. A ruined silk shirt with bag sleeves and smocking at the neck of it, and worsted leggings and short ragged pantaloons. In some he was dressed as men had been centuries before. I had seen such clothes in tapestries in my home, in the paintings of Caravaggio and Latour that hung in my mother's rooms.
"You're perfect, my Lelio, my wolf killer," he said to me,
his long mouth opening wide so that again I saw the small white fangs. They were the only teeth he possessed. I shuddered. I felt myself dropping to the floor. But he picked me up easily with one arm and laid me down gently on the bed. In my mind I was praying fiercely, "God, help me! The Virgin Mary, help me! Help me! Help me!" as I peered up into his face. What was it I was seeing? What had I seen the night before? The mask of old age, this grinning thing cut deeply with the marks of time, and yet frozen, it seemed, and hard as his hands. He wasn't a living thing. He was a monster. A vampire was what he was, a blood-sucking corpse from the grave gifted with intellect. And his limbs, why did they so horrify me? He looked like a human, but he didn't move like a human. It didn't seem to matter to him whether he walked or crawled, bent over or knelt. It filled me with loathing. Yet he fascinated me. I had to admit it, he fascinated me. But I was in too much danger to allow such a strange state of mind. He gave a deep laugh now, his knees wide apart, his fingers resting on my cheek as he made a great arc over me.
"Yes, lovely one. I'm hard to look at," he said. His voice was still a whisper, and he spoke in long gasps. "I was old when I was made. And you're perfect, my Lelio, my blue-eyed young one. More beautiful even without the lights of the stage."
The long white hand played with my hair again, lifting up the strands and letting them drop as he sighed.
"Don't weep, wolf killer," he said. "You're chosen. And your tawdry little triumphs in the House of Thespians will be nothing once this night comes to a close."
Again came that low riot of laughter. There was no doubt in my mind, at least at this moment, that he was from the devil, that God and the devil existed, that beyond the isolation I'd known only hours ago lay this vast realm of dark beings and hideous meanings, and I had been swallowed into it somehow. It occurred to me quite clearly I was being punished for my life. And yet that seemed absurd. Millions believed as I believed, the world over. Why the hell was this happening to me? And a grim possibility started irresistibly to take shape, that the world was no more meaningful than before, and this was but another horror. "In God's name, get away!" I shouted. I had to believe in God now. I had to. That was absolutely the only hope. I went to make the sign of the cross. For one moment he stared at me, his eyes wide with rage, and then he remained still. He watched me make the sign of the cross. He listened to me call upon God again and again. He only smiled, making his face a perfect mask of comedy from the proscenium arch. And I went into a spasm of crying like a child. "Then the devil reigns in heaven, and heaven is hell," I said to him. "Oh, God, don't desert me." I called on all the saints I had ever for a little while loved. He struck me hard across the face. I fell to one side and almost slipped from the bed to the floor. The room went round. The sour taste of the wine rose in my mouth, and I felt his fingers again on my neck.
"Yes, fight, wolf-killer," he said. "Don't go into hell without a battle. Mock God."
"I don't mock," I protested. Once again he pulled me to himself, and I fought him harder than I had ever fought anyone or anything in my existence, even the wolves. I beat on him, kicked him, tore at his hair. But I might as well have fought the animated gargoyles from a cathedral, he was that powerful. He only smiled. Then all the expression went out of his face. It seemed to become very long. The cheeks were hollow, the eyes wide and almost wondering, and he opened his mouth. The lower lip contracted. I saw the fangs.
"Damn you! Damn you! Damn you!"
I was roaring and bellowing, and he drew closer, and the teeth went through my flesh. "Not this time," I was raging. "Not this time! I will not feel it. I will resist. I will fight for my soul this time." But it was happening again. The sweetness and the softness and the world far away, and even he in his ugliness was curiously outside of me, like an insect pressed against a glass who causes no loathing in us because he cannot touch us, and the sound of the gong, and the exquisite pleasure. And then I was altogether lost. I was incorporeal, and the pleasure was incorporeal. I was nothing but pleasure. And I slipped into a web of radiant dreams. A catacomb I saw, a rank place, and a white vampire creature waking in a shallow grave. Bound in heavy chains he was, the vampire, and over him bent this monster who had abducted me. And I knew that his name was Magnus, and that he was mortal still in this dream, a great and powerful alchemist, and he had unearthed and bound this slumbering vampire right before the crucial hour of dusk. And now, as the light died out of the heavens, Magnus drank from his helpless, immortal prisoner the magical and accursed blood that would make him one of the living dead. Treachery it was, the theft of immortality, a dark Prometheus stealing a luminescent fire. Laughter in the darkness. Laughter echoing in the catacomb. Echoing as if down the centuries. And the stench of the grave. And the ecstasy, absolutely fathomless and irresistible. And then drawing to a finish. I was crying. I lay on the straw and I said, "Please, don't stop it." Magnus was no longer holding me, and my breathing was once again my own, and the dreams were dissolved. I fell down and down as the night full of stars slid upwards, jewels affixed to a dark purple veil. Clever, that. I had thought this sky was real. The cold winter air was moving just a little in this room. I felt the tears on my face. I was consumed with thirst. And far, far away from me, Magnus stood looking down at me, his hands dangling low beside his thin legs. I tried to move. I was craving. My whole body was thirsty. "You're dying, wolf-killer," he said. "The light's going out of your blue eyes as if all the summer days are gone."
"No, please!"
This thirst was unbearable. My mouth was open, gaping, my back arched, and it was here. At last, the final horror, death itself, like this.
"Ask for it, child," he said,
his face no longer the grinning mask, but utterly transfigured with compassion. He looked almost human, almost naturally old.
"Ask and you shall receive," he said.
I saw water rushing down all the mountain streams of my childhood.
"Help me, please."
"I shall give you the water of all waters," he said in my ear,
and it seemed he wasn't white at all. He was just an old man sitting there beside me. His face was human and almost sad. But as I watched his smile and his grey eyebrows rise in wonder, I knew it wasn't true. He wasn't human. He was that same ancient monster, only he was filled with my blood.
"The wine of all wines," he breathed, "This is my body. This is my blood." And then his arms surrounded me. They drew me to him, and I felt a great warmth emanating from him, and he seemed to be filled not with blood, but with love for me. "Ask for it, Wolfkiller, and you will live forever," he said. But his voice sounded weary and spiritless, and there was something distant and tragic in his gaze. I felt my head turn to the side, my body a heavy and damp thing that I could not control. "I will not ask. I will die without asking." And then the great despair I feared so much lay before me, the emptiness that was death, and still I said no. In pure horror I said no. I will not bow down to it, the chaos and the horror. I said no. "Life everlasting," he whispered. My head fell on his shoulder. "Stubborn Wolfkiller," his lips touched me, warm, odorless breath on my neck. "Not stubborn," I whispered. My voice was so weak I wondered if he could hear me. "Brave, not stubborn." It seemed pointless not to say it. What was vanity now? What was anything at all? And such a trivial word was stubborn, so cruel. He lifted my face, and holding me with his right hand, he lifted his left hand and gashed his own throat with its nails. My body bent double in a convulsion of terror, but he pressed my face to the wound as he said, "Drink." I heard my scream, deafening in my own ears, and the blood that was flowing out of the wound touched my parched and cracking lips. The thirst seemed to hiss aloud. My tongue licked at the blood, and a great whiplash of sensation caught me, and my mouth opened and locked itself to the wound. I drew with all my power upon the great fount that I knew would satisfy my thirst as it had never been satisfied before. Blood and blood and blood. And it was not merely the dry hissing coil of the thirst that was quenched and dissolved. It was all my craving, all the want and misery and hunger that I had ever known. My mouth widened, pressed harder to him. I felt the blood coursing down the length of my throat. I felt his head against me. I felt the tight enclosure of his arms. I was against him, and I could feel his sinews, his bones, the very contour of his hands. I knew his body. And yet there was this numbness creeping through me, and a rapturous tingling as each sensation penetrated the numbness and was amplified in the penetration so that it became fuller, keener, and I could almost see what I felt. But the supreme part of it remained, the sweet, luscious blood filling me as I drank and drank. More of it. More. This was all I could think, if I thought at all. And for all its thick substance it was like light passing into me, so brilliant did it seem to the mind, so blinding that red stream. And all the desperate desires of my life were a thousandfold fed. But his body, the scaffolding to which I clung, was weakening beneath me. I could hear his breath in feeble gasps, yet he didn't make me stop. "Love you," I wanted to say. "Magnus, my unearthly master, ghastly thing that you are, love you, love you." This was what I had always so wanted and could never have. "This, and you've given it to me." I felt I would die if it went on, and on it did go, and I did not die. But quite suddenly I felt his gentle, loving hands caressing my shoulders, and with his incalculable strength he forced me backwards. I let out a long, mournful cry. Its misery alarmed me. But he was pulling me to my feet. He still held me in his arms. He brought me to the window, and I stood looking out, with my hands out to the stone on either side. I was shaking, and the blood in me pulsed in all my veins. I leaned my forehead against the iron bars. Far, far below lay the dark cusp of a hill,
overgrown with trees that appeared to shimmer in the faint light of the stars. And beyond, the city, with its wilderness of little lights, sunk not in darkness, but in a soft violet mist. The snow everywhere was luminescent, melting. Rooftops, towers, walls, all were myriad facets of lavender, mauve, rose. This was the sprawling metropolis. And as I narrowed my eyes, I saw a million windows, like so many projections of beams of light, and then, as if this were not enough, in the very depths I saw the unmistakable movement of the people. Tiny mortals on tiny streets, heads and hands touching in the shadows, a lone man, no more than a speck ascending a wind-blown belfry. A million souls on the tessellated surface of the night, and coming soft on the air, a dim mingling of countless human voices, cries, songs, the faintest wisps of music, the muted throb of bells. I moaned. The breeze seemed to lift my hair, and I heard my own voice as I had never heard it before, crying. The city dimmed. I let it go, its swarming millions lost again in the vast and wondrous play of lilac shadow and fading light. Oh, what have you done? What is this that you've given to me? I whispered. And it seemed my words did not stop, one after another. Rather, they ran together until all of my crying was one immense and coherent sound that perfectly amplified my horror and my joy. If there was a God, he did not matter now. He was part of some dull and dreary realm whose secrets had long ago been plundered, whose lights had long ago gone out. This was the pulsing center of life itself, round which all true complexity revolved. Ah, the allure of that complexity, the sense of being there. Behind me the scratch of the monster's feet came on the stones, and when I turned I saw him, white and bled dry and like a great husk of himself. His eyes were stained with blood-red tears, and he reached out to me as if in pain. I gathered him to my chest. I felt such love for him as I had never known before. "Ah, don't you see?" came the ghastly voice with its long words, whispers without end. "My heir chosen to take the dark gift from me, with more fibre and courage than 10 mortal men. What a child of darkness you are to be!" I kissed his eyelids. I gathered his soft black hair in my hands. He was no ghastly thing to me now, but merely that which was strange and white, and full of some deeper lesson, perhaps, than the sighing trees below, or the shimmering city calling me over the miles. His sunken cheeks, his long throat, the thin legs, these were but the natural parts of him. "No, fledgling," he sighed, "save your kisses for the world. My time has come, and you owe me but one obeisance only. Follow me now." 3. Down a winding stairs he drew me, and everything I beheld absorbed me. The rough-cut stones seemed to give forth their own light, and even the rats shooting past in the dark had a curious beauty. Then he unlocked a thick, iron-studded wooden door, and giving over his heavy keyring to me, led me into a large and barren room. "You are now my heir, as I told you," he said. "You will take possession of this house and all my treasure, but you'll do as I say first." The barred windows gave a limitless view of the moonlit clouds, and I saw the soft, shimmering city again as if it were spreading its arms. "Ah, later you may drink your fill of all you see," he said. He turned me towards him as he stood before a huge heap of wood that lay in the center of the floor. "Listen carefully," he said, "for I'm about to leave you." He gestured to the wood offhandedly. "And there are things you must know. You're immortal now, and your nature shall lead you soon enough to your first human victim. Be swift,
and show no mercy. But stop your feasting, no matter how delicious, before the victim's heart ceases to beat. In years to come, you'll be strong enough to feel that great moment, but for the present, pass the cup to time just before it's empty, or you may pay heavily for your pride. But why are you leaving me? I asked desperately. I clung to him. Victims, mercy, feasting. I felt myself bombarded by these words as if I were being physically beaten. He pulled away so easily that my hands were hurt by his movement, and I wound up staring at them, marveling at the strange quality of the pain. It wasn't like mortal pain. He stopped, however, and pointed to the stones of the wall opposite. I could see that one very large stone had been dislodged, and lay a foot from the unbroken surface around it. "Grasp that stone," he said, "and pull it out of the wall." "But I can't," I said. "It must wait." "Pull it out." He pointed with one of his long, bony fingers and grimaced, so that I tried to do it as he said. To my pure astonishment, I was able to move the stone easily, and I saw beyond it a dark opening just large enough for a man to enter if he crawled on his face. He gave a dry, cackling laugh and nodded his head. "There, my son, is the passageway that leads to my treasure," he said. "Do with my treasure as you like, and with all my earthly property. But for now, I must have my vows." And again, astonishing me, he snatched up two twigs from the wood and rubbed them together so fiercely they were soon burning with bright, small flames. This he tossed at the heap, and the pitch in it caused the fire to leap up at once, throwing an immense light over the curved ceiling and the stone walls. I gasped and stepped back. The riot of yellow and orange color enchanted and frightened me, and the heat, though I felt it, did not cause me a sensation I understood. There was no natural alarm that I should be burned by it. Rather, the warmth was exquisite, and I realized for the first time how cold I had been. The cold was an icing on me, and the fire melted it, and I almost moaned. He laughed again, that hollow, gasping laugh, and started to dance about in the light, his thin legs making him look like a skeleton dancing with the white face of a man. He crooked his arms over his head, bent his torso and his knees, and turned round and round as he circled the fire. "Mon Dieu," I whispered. I was reeling. Horrifying it might have been only an hour ago to see him dancing like this, but now in the flickering glare he was a spectacle that drew me after it step by step. The light exploded on his satin rags, the pantaloons he wore, the tattered shirt. "But you can't leave me," I pleaded, trying to keep my thoughts clear, trying to realize what he had been saying. My voice was monstrous in my ears. I tried to make it lower, softer, more like it should have been. "Where will you go?" He gave his loudest laugh then, slapped his thigh, and dancing faster and farther away from me, his hands out as if to embrace the fire. The thickest logs were only now catching. The room, for all its size, was like a great clay oven, smoke pouring out its windows. "Not the fire!" I flew backwards, flattening myself against the wall. "You can't go into the fire!" Fear was overwhelming me, as every sight and sound had overwhelmed me. It was like every sensation I had known so far. I couldn't resist it or deny it. I was half whimpering and half screaming. "Oh, yes, I can," he laughed. "Yes, I can." He threw back his head and let his laughter stretch into howls. "But from you, fledgling," he said, stopping before me with his finger out again, "promises now. Come, a little mortal honour, my brave wolf-killer, although it will cleave my heart in two, I shall throw you into the fire and claim for myself another offspring. Answer me." I tried to speak. I nodded my head. In the raging light I could see my hands had become white, and I felt a stab of pain in my lower lip that almost made me cry out. My eye-teeth had become fangs already. I felt them and looked at him in panic, but he was leering at me as if he enjoyed my terror. "Now, after I am burned up," he said, snatching my wrist, "and the fire is out. You must scatter the ashes.
Hear me, little one. Scatter the ashes, or else I might return, and in what shape that would be I dare not contemplate. But mark my words, if you allow me to come back, more hideous than I am now, I shall hunt you down and burn you till you are scarred the same as I. Do you hear me?"
I still couldn't bring myself to answer. This was not fear. It was hell. I could feel my teeth growing and my body tingling all over. Frantically, I nodded my head.
"Ah, yes."
He smiled, nodding too, the fire licking the ceiling behind him, the light leaking all about the edges of his face.
"It's only mercy I ask, that I go now to find hell, if there is a hell, or sweet oblivion which surely I do not deserve. If there is a prince of darkness, then I shall set eyes upon him at last. I shall spit in his face. So scatter what is burned, as I command you. And when that is done, take yourself to my lair through that low passage, being most careful to replace the stone behind you as you enter there. Within you will find my coffin, and in that box, or the like of it, you must seal yourself by day, or the sun's light shall burn you to a cinder. Mark my words, nothing on earth can end your life, save the sun or a blaze such as you see before you, and even then, only, and I say only, if your ashes are scattered when it is done."
I turned my face away from him and away from the flames. I had begun to cry, and the only thing that kept me from sobbing was the hand I clapped to my mouth. But he pulled me about the edge of the fire until we stood before the loose stone, his finger pointing at it again.
"Please stay with me, please," I begged him. "Only a little while, only one night, I beg you."
Again the volume of my voice terrified me. It wasn't my voice at all. I put my arms around him. I held tight to him. His gaunt, white face was inexplicably beautiful to me, his black eyes filled with the strangest expression. The light flickered on his hair, his eyes, and then again he made his mouth into a jester's smile.
"Ah, greedy son," he said, "is it not enough to be immortal? With all the world your repast? Goodbye, little one. Do as I say. Remember the ashes. And beyond this stone the inner chamber. Therein lies all that you will need to prosper."
I struggled to hold on to him, and he laughed low in my ear, marveling at my strength.
"Excellent, excellent," he whispered. "Now live forever, beautiful wolf-killer, with the gifts which I have added to the lot."
He sent me stumbling away from him, and he leapt so high and so far into the very middle of the flames he appeared to be flying. I saw him descend. I saw the fire catch his garments. It seemed his head became a torch, and then all of a sudden his eyes grew wide, and his mouth became a great black cavern in the radiance of the flames, and his laughter rose in such piercing volume I covered my ears. He appeared to jump up and down on all fours in the flames, and suddenly I realized that my cries had drowned out his laughter. The spindly black arms and legs rose and fell, and then suddenly appeared to wither. The fire shifted, roared. And in the heart of it I could see nothing now but the blaze itself. Yet still I cried. I fell down upon my knees, my hands over my eyes. But against my closed lids I could still see it. One vast explosion of sparks after another, until I pressed my forehead on the stones. 4. For years, it seemed, I lay on the floor, watching the fire burn itself out to charred timbers. The room had cooled, the freezing air moved through the open window, and again I wept. My own sobs reverberated in my ears until I felt I couldn't endure the sound of them. And it was no comfort to know that all things were magnified in this state, even the misery that I felt. Now and then I prayed again. I begged for forgiveness. though forgiveness for what I couldn't have said. I prayed to the Blessed Mother, to the saints. I murmured the Aves over and over until they became a senseless chant, and my tears were blood, and they left their stain on my hands when I wiped at my face. Then I lay flat on the stones, murmuring not prayers any longer, but those inarticulate pleas we make to all that is powerful, all that is holy, all that may or may not exist by any and all names. Do not leave me alone here. Do not abandon me. I am in the witch's place. It's the witch's place. Do not let me fall even farther than I have already fallen this night. Do not let it happen. Lestat, wake up! But Magnus's words came back to me over and over. To find hell, if there is a hell, if there is a prince of darkness. Finally I rose on my hands and knees. I felt light-headed and mad, and almost giddy. I looked at the fire, and saw that I might still bring it back to a roaring blaze and throw myself into it. But even as I forced myself to imagine the agony of this, I knew that I had no intention of doing it. After all, why should I do it? What had I done to deserve the witch's fate? I didn't want to be in hell, even for a moment. I sure as hell wasn't going there just to spit in the face of the Prince of Darkness, whoever he might be. On the contrary, if I was a damned thing, then let the son of a bitch come for me. Let him tell me why I was meant to suffer. I would truly like to know. As for oblivion, well, we can wait a little while for that. We can think this over for a little while, at least. An alien calm crept slowly over me. I was dark, full of bitterness and growing fascination. I wasn't human any more. And as I crouched there thinking about it, and looking at the dying embers, an immense strength was gathering in me. Gradually my boyish sobs died away, and I commenced to study the whiteness of my skin, the sharpness of the two evil little teeth, and the way that my fingernails gleamed in the dark as though they'd been lacquered. All the little familiar aches were gone out of my body, and the remaining warmth that came from the smoking wood was good to me, as something laid over me or wrapped about me. Time passed, yet it did not pass. Each change in the moving air was caressing, and when there came from the softly lighted city beyond a chorus of dim church bells ringing the hour, they did not mark the passage of mortal time. They were only the purest music, and I lay stunned, my mouth open, as I stared at the passing clouds. But in my chest I started to feel a new pain, very hot and mercurial. It moved through my veins, tightened about my head, and then seemed to collect itself in my bowels and belly. I narrowed my eyes. I cocked my head to one side. I realized I wasn't afraid of this pain. Rather, I was feeling it as if I were listening to it. And I saw the cause of it then. My waste was leaving me in a small torrent. I found myself unable to control it. Yet as I watched the foulness stain my clothes, this didn't disgust me. Rats creeping into the very room, approaching this filth on their tiny soundless feet, even these did not disgust me. These things couldn't touch me, even as they crawled over me to devour the waste. In fact, I could imagine nothing in the dark, not even the slithering insects of the grave, that could bring about revulsion in me. Let them crawl on my hands and face, it wouldn't matter now. I wasn't part of the world that cringed at such things, and with a smile I realized that I was of the dark ilk that makes others cringe. Slowly and with great pleasure, I laughed. And yet my grief was not entirely gone from me. It lingered like an idea, and that idea had a pure truth to it. I am dead. I am a vampire. And things will die so that I may live. I will drink their blood so that I may live. And I will never,
never see Nicholas again, nor my mother, nor any of the humans I have known and loved, nor any of my human family. I'll drink blood, and I'll live forever. That is exactly what will be, and what will be is only beginning. It is just born, and the labor that brought it forth was rapture such as I have never known. I climbed to my feet. I felt myself light and powerful, and strangely numbed, and I went to the dead fire and walked through the burnt timbers. There were no bones. It was as if the fiend had disintegrated. What ashes I could gather in my hands I took to the window, and as the wind caught them, I whispered a farewell to Magnus, wondering if he could yet hear me. At last only charred logs were left, and the soot that I wiped up with my hands and dusted off into the darkness. It was time now to examine the inner room. 5. The stone moved out easily enough, as I'd seen before, and it had a hook on the inside of it by which I could pull it closed behind me. But to get into the narrow, dark passage I had to lie on my belly, and when I dropped down on my knees and peered into it, I could see no visible light at the end. I didn't like the look of it. I knew that if I'd been mortal still, nothing could have induced me to crawl into a passage like this. But the old vampire had been plain enough in telling me the sun could destroy me as surely as the fire. I had to get to the coffin, and I felt the fear coming back in a deluge. I got down flat on the ground and crawled, as a lizard might, into the passage. As I feared, I could not really raise my head, and there was no room to turn and reach for the hook in the stone. I had to slip my foot into the hook and crawl forward to pull this stone behind me. Total darkness, with room to rise only a few inches on my elbows. I gasped, and the fear welled, and I almost went mad thinking about the fact that I couldn't raise my head, and finally I smacked it against the stone and lay still, whimpering. But what was I to do? I must reach the coffin. So telling myself to stop this whining, I commenced to crawl faster and faster. My knees scraped the stone. My hands sought crevices and cracks to pull me along. My neck ached with a strain as I struggled not to try to lift my head again in panic. And when my hand suddenly felt solid stone ahead, I pushed upon it with all my strength. I felt it move as a pale light seeped in. I scrambled out of the passage and found myself standing in a small room. The ceiling was low, curved, and the high window was narrow, with a familiar heavy grid of iron bars. But the sweet, violet light of the night poured in, revealing a great fireplace cut in the far wall, the wood ready for the torch, and beside it, beneath the window, an ancient stone sarcophagus. My red, velvet, fur-lined cape lay over the sarcophagus, and on a rude bench I glimpsed a splendid suit of red velvet worked with gold and much Italian lace, as well as red silk breeches and white silk hose and red-heeled slippers. I smoothed back my hair from my face and wiped the thin film of sweat from my upper lip and my forehead. It was bloody, this sweat, and when I saw this on my hands, I felt a curious excitement. Ah, what am I thought, and what lies before me? For a long moment I looked at this blood, and then I licked my fingers. A lovely, zinging pleasure passed through me. It was a moment before I could collect myself sufficiently to approach the fireplace. I lifted two sticks of kindling, as the old vampire had done, and rubbing them very hard and fast, saw them almost disappear as the flame shot up from them. There was no magic in this, only skill. And as the fire warmed me, I took off my soiled clothes, and with my shirt wiped every last trace of human waste away, and threw all this in the fire, before putting on the new garments. Red. Dazzling red. Not even Nicholas had had such clothes as these. They were clothes for the court at Versailles, with pearls and tiny rubies worked into their embroidery. The lace of the shirt was Valenciennes,
which I had seen on my mother's wedding gown. I put the wolf cape over my shoulders, and though the white chill was gone from my limbs, I felt like a creature carved from ice. My smile felt hard and glittering to me, and strangely slow, as I allowed myself to feel and to see these garments. In the blaze of the fire I looked at the coffin. The effigy of an old man was carved upon its heavy lid, and I realized immediately it was the likeness of Magnus. But here he lay in tranquillity, his jester's mouth sealed, his eyes staring mildly at the ceiling, his hair a neat mane of deeply carved waves and ringlets. 3 centuries old was this thing, surely. He lay with his hands folded on his chest, his garments long robes, and from his sword that had been carved into the stone, someone had broken out the hilt and part of the scabbard. I stared at this for an interminable length of time, seeing that it had been carefully chipped away with much effort. Was it the shape of the cross that someone had sought to remove? I traced it over with my finger. Nothing happened, of course, any more than when I'd murmured all those prayers, and squatting in the dust beside the coffin, I drew a cross there. Again, nothing. Then to the cross I added a few strokes, to suggest the body of Christ, his arms, the crook of his knees, his bowed head. I wrote, "The Lord Jesus Christ," the only words I could write well, save for my own name. And again, nothing. And still glancing back uneasily at the words and the little crucifix, I tried to lift the lid of the coffin. Even with this new strength it was not easy, and no mortal man alone could have done it. But what perplexed me was the extent of my difficulty. I did not have limitless strength, and certainly I didn't have the strength of the old vampire. Maybe the strength of 3 men was what I now possessed, or the strength of 4. It was impossible to calculate. It seemed pretty damned impressive to me at the moment. I looked into the coffin. Nothing but a narrow place, full of shadows, where I couldn't imagine myself lying. There were Latin words inscribed around the rim, and I couldn't read them. This tormented me. I wished the words weren't there, and my longing for Magnus, my helplessness, threatened to close in on me. I hated him for leaving me. And it struck me with full ironic force that I'd felt love for him before he'd leapt into the fire. I'd felt love for him when I saw the red garments. Do devils love each other? Do they walk arm in arm in hell, saying, "Ah, you are my friend, how I love you," things like that to each other? It was a rather detached intellectual question I was asking, as I did not believe in hell. But it was a matter of a concept of evil, wasn't it? All creatures in hell are supposed to hate one another, as all the saved hate the damned, without reservation. I'd known that all my life. It had terrified me as a child, the idea that I might go to heaven, and my mother might go to hell, and that I should hate her. I couldn't hate her. And what if we were in hell together? Well, now I know, whether I believe in hell or not, that vampires can love each other, that in being dedicated to evil one does not cease to love. Or so it seemed for that brief instant. But don't start crying again, I can't abide all this crying. I turned my eyes to a large wooden chest that was partially hidden at the head of the coffin. It wasn't locked. Its rotted wooden lid fell almost off the hinges when I opened it. And though the old master had said he was leaving me his treasure, I was flabbergasted by what I saw there. The chest was crammed with gems, and gold and silver. There were countless jeweled rings, diamond necklaces, ropes of pearls, plate and coins, and hundreds upon hundreds of miscellaneous valuables. I ran my fingers lightly over the heap and then held up handfuls of it, gasping as the light ignited the red of the rubies, the green of the emeralds. I saw refractions of colour of which I'd never dreamed, and wealth beyond any calculation. It was the fabled Caribbean pirate's chest, the proverbial king's ransom. And it was mine now. More slowly I examined it. Scattered throughout were personal and perishable articles,
sat in masks, rotting away from their trimming of gold, lace handkerchiefs and bits of cloth to which were fixed pins and brooches. Here was a strip of leather harness, hung with gold bells, a mouldering bit of lace slipped through a ring, snuff boxes by the dozens, lockets of velvet ribbon. Had Magnus taken all this from his victims? I lifted up a jewel-encrusted sword, far too heavy for these times, and a worn slipper saved, perhaps, for its rhinestone buckle. Of course he had taken what he wanted. Yet he himself had worn rags, the tattered costume of another age, and he lived here as a hermit might have lived in some earlier century. I couldn't understand it. But there were other objects scattered about in this treasure. Rosaries made up of gorgeous gems, and they still had their crucifixes. I touched the small sacred images. I shook my head and bit my lip, as if to say, "How awful that he should have stolen these!" But I also found it very funny, and further proof that God had no power over me. And as I was thinking about this, trying to decide if it was as fortuitous as it seemed for the moment, I lifted from the treasure an exquisite pearl-handled mirror. I looked into it almost unconsciously, as one often glances in mirrors. And there I saw myself as a man might expect, except that my skin was very white, as the old fiends had been white, and my eyes had been transformed from their usual blue to a mingling of violet and cobalt that was softly iridescent. My hair had a high, luminous sheen, and when I ran my fingers back through it, I felt a new and strange vitality there. In fact, this was not Lestat in the mirror at all, but some replica of him made of other substances. And the few lines time had given me by the age of 20 years were gone, or greatly simplified and just a little deeper than they had been. I stared at my reflection. I became frantic to discover myself in it. I rubbed my face, even rubbed the mirror, and pressed my lips together to keep from crying. Finally I closed my eyes and opened them again, and I smiled very gently at the creature. He smiled back. That was Lestat, all right, and there seemed nothing in his face that was any way malevolent. Well, not very malevolent. Just the old mischief, the impulsiveness. He could have been an angel, in fact, this creature, except that when his tears did rise they were red, and the entire image was tinted red because his vision was red, and he had these evil little teeth that he could press into his lower lip when he smiled that made him look absolutely terrifying. A good enough face, with one thing horribly, horribly wrong with it. But it suddenly occurred to me. I am looking at my own reflection. And hadn't it been said enough that ghosts and spirits and those who have lost their souls to hell have no reflections in mirrors? A lust to know all things about what I was came over me. A lust to know how I should walk among mortal men. I wanted to be in the streets of Paris, seeing with my new eyes all the miracles of life that I'd ever glimpsed. I wanted to see the faces of the people, to see the flowers in bloom and the butterflies, to see Nicky, to hear Nicky play his music. No. Forswear that. But there were a thousand forms of music, weren't there? And as I closed my eyes, I could almost hear the orchestra or the opera, the arias rising in my ears. So sharp the recollection, so clear. But nothing would be ordinary now, not joy or pain, or the simplest memory. All would possess this magnificent luster, even grief for the things that were forever lost. I put down the mirror, and taking one of the old yellowed lace handkerchiefs from the chest, I wiped my tears. I turned and sat down slowly before the fire. Delicious, the warmth on my face and hands. A great, sweet drowsiness came over me, and as I closed my eyes again I felt myself immersed suddenly in the strange dream of Magnus stealing the blood. A sense of enchantment returned, of dizzying pleasure. Magnus holding me. Connected to me, my blood flowing into him. But I heard the chains scraping the floor of the old catacomb. I saw the defenseless vampire thing in Magnus's arms. Something more to it. Something important.
a meaning.
About theft, treachery, about surrendering to no one, not God, not demon, and never man. I thought and thought about it, half awake, half dreaming again, and the maddest thought came to me that I would tell Nicky all about this, that as soon as I got home I would lay it all out, the dream, the possible meaning, and we would talk. With an ugly shock I opened my eyes. The human in me looked helplessly about this chamber. He started to weep again, and the newborn fiend was too young yet to rein him in. The sobs came up like hiccups, and I put my hand over my mouth.
"Magnus, why did you leave me? Magnus, what am I supposed to do? How do I go on?"
I drew up my knees and rested my head on them, and slowly my head began to clear. "Well, it has been great fun pretending you will be this vampire creature," I thought, "wearing these splendid clothes, running your fingers through all that glorious lucre. But you can't live as this. You can't feed on living beings. Even if you are a monster, you have a conscience in you, natural to you, good and evil. Good and evil. You cannot live without believing in... You cannot abide the acts that... Tomorrow you will... You will what? You will drink blood, won't you?" The gold and the precious stones glowed like embers in the nearby chest, and beyond the bars of the window they rose against the grey clouds, the violet shimmer of the distant city. What is their blood like? Hot, living blood, not monster blood. My tongue pushed at the roof of my mouth, at my fangs. Think on it, Wolfkiller. I rose to my feet slowly. It was as if the will made it happen rather than the body, so easy was it, and I picked up the iron keyring which I'd brought with me from the outer chamber, and I went to inspect the rest of my tower. 6. Empty chambers, barred windows, the great endless sweep of the night above the battlements, that is all I found above ground. But on the lower floor of the tower, just outside the door to the dungeon stairs, there was a resin torch in the sconce and a tinderbox in the niche beside it, tracks in the dust, the lock well oiled and easy to turn when I finally found the right key for it. I shone the torch before me on a narrow screw stairway and started down, a little repelled by a stench that rose from somewhere quite far below me. Of course I knew that stench. It was common enough in every cemetery in Paris. In Les Innocents it was thick as noxious gas, and you had to live with it to shop the stalls there, deal with the letter writers. It was the stench of decomposing bodies. And though it sickened me, made me back up a few steps, it wasn't all that strong, and the odor of the burning resin helped to subdue it. I went on down. If there were dead mortals here, well, I couldn't run away from them. But on the first level beneath the ground I found no corpses, only a vast cool burial chamber with its rusted iron doors open to the stairs, and 3 giant stone sarcophagi in the center of it. It was very like Magnus's cell above, only much larger. It had the same low curved ceiling, the same crude and gaping fireplace. And what could that mean, except that other vampires had once slept here? No one puts fireplaces in burial vaults, at least not that I had ever known. And there were even stone benches here. And the sarcophagi were like the one above, with great figures carved on them. But years of dust overlay everything, and there were so many spider webs. Surely no vampires dwelled here now. Quite impossible. Yet it was very strange. Where were those who had lain in these coffins? Had they burnt themselves up, like Magnus, or were they still existing somewhere? I went in and opened the sarcophagi one by one. Nothing but dust inside. No evidence of other vampires at all. No indication that any other vampires existed. I went out and continued down the stairway, even though the smell of the decay grew stronger and stronger. In fact, it very quickly became unbearable. It was coming from behind a door that I could see below, and I had real difficulty in making myself approach it. Of course, as a mortal man, I loathed this smell, but that was nothing to the aversion I felt now. My new body wanted to run from